Newcastle 1, race officer speaking.
Pressure coming here, pressure coming.
We're 1.5 below.
1.5 below.
Two dives here, boys. We're looking at 10.5 and 42.
Hello, dear podcast listeners, and thank you so much for joining us. We hope you all enjoyed part one of Sir Robin's podcast. If you haven't listened to part one, maybe scroll back and give it a go first. It details the amazing account of Sir Robin's world-beating race around the planet to become the first ever man to sail non-stop solo around the globe. It's an incredible story. While part one relates to Robin's early life and that remarkable 312-day voyage, part two has to then cram in the rest of his sailing achievements. We talk with Robin about how his world first opened doors in the sailing world, and also how the landscape looked for a professional competitive sailor back in the real fledgling days of pro sailing as a sport. As you would imagine, Robin jumped in with 2 feet and was soon blazing a trail around the world again, first in the Whitbread and then trying to break the 80-day challenge of the newly formed Jules Verne Trophy. We then go on to discuss how a discussion with British climbing supremo and expedition leader Sir Chris Bonington planted a seed that would become the Clipper Race. An open to all crude circumnavigation experience that has opened the door to offshore sailing to thousands of amateur sailors. It was a real pleasure to sit and chat with Robin. We got together thanks to the kind hospitality of Portsmouth Sailing Club. So a big thank you to them and of course to Sir Robin for being so generous with his time. I hope you enjoy part two of the time I spent with Sir Robin Knox Johnston.
The objective is to win, isn't it? It's like going to the boxing ring. Why come second? Well, we could see where he was because the albatross was circling. That was the equivalent to taking a mini out of the boat at 35 feet above the deck.
Well, Robin, back to you. I mean, you left the UK as a young merchant seaman and came back home a national hero. What was the new life like for Robin Knox Johnston, and I guess what opportunities opened up for him?
Well, my initial thing, the moment I got back, I got 60 days to write a book. And so for the first 20 days, I'm living it up, you know, going to nightclubs. Wow, I'm alive, great. And then suddenly they said, when's this book going to be? So, all right, I'll get on with it. So I started writing very hard. And I got it finished in time. So the next thing we're going to do is wait for it to be printed, and then you go around the country, book signing, that sort of thing. And that was 2 months of that. It was quite hard work, averaging 4 events a day. But Castles were the publisher. They're a very good bunch, and they did look after me well. And then it's a question, what next? And I was going to go back to sea, perfectly happy with the company. And, you know, I met some of the directors. In fact, we went out and had dinner and discussed it. And although they'd said, you know, we're cutting you off, you can't keep going away sailing. You can't keep expecting to keep your seniority. When I got back, you know, having won this thing, they decided they would. So in fact, they gave me the check for my what I would have earned had I stayed with them, which was very generous of. But I was just going to go back to sea, and it was a question of which ship. And their plan was for me to go on the Navassa, which did school cruises, first officer, and, you know, I was a first officer. And then they wanted to use me where I'd mix with the public. That made sense, really, if you think about it. But then one of the directors said, are you free tonight? Yeah, come on out and have dinner. He said, if you tell anyone this, I'll kill you. I said, okay. He said, company's disappearing. I said, what? It's all being absorbed. McKinsey's done a report. All the companies in the P&O group are being absorbed into one. So the company you've spent 14 years with is disappearing. I said, well, I'm not doing that. I loaded for P&O, they didn't have a clue. That's mate on a ship. No, I'm not doing that. So that meant I had to change careers. Well, then I was approached by someone who said, are you interested in getting involved in a... And I started looking around at boatyards, funny enough. And then someone approached me and said, you're interested in a project on the Hamble. I thought, yeah, what is it? We went down and looked at Mercury, which wasn't called Mercury then. And there was a boatyard building power boats and outline planning for a marina. So we put a syndicate together and bought it, carried on the boat building and built the marina. And that's Mercury Yacht Harbour. So I sort of changed careers, really. And the Merchant Navy at that time suddenly disappeared, basically. At my age group, awful lot of us were out of jobs because that amalgamation in the P&O group, I mean, 220 dry cargo ships became 20 in about 2 years. Well, where's the jobs? So awful lot of us had to go out and find other jobs. I was probably in a better position than most, but it wasn't an easy time for people.
I mean, your return had marked a golden age of British domination of shorthanded sailing. How keen were you to do more of all of that?
Oh, I got really involved in it. 1970, we built Ocean Spirit and won the Round Britain race, 71-footer. Everyone said it was too big for two people. In any case, a monohull can never win the race. Well, it's the only time a monohull has. 71, I raced with Max Aitken on Crusade. 73, was Admiral's Cup on Frigate. Oh, that was fun. I really enjoyed that. 74, another Round Britain race. Won that in a big catamaran. 75, Admiral's Cup. We were selected and they dropped the spinnaker pole on my head, so I slipped a disc, so I missed it. 76, Tony Morgan and I did a deal for more opposition. I raced around Britain, won the Rourke Class 1 Points Championship. 77, Condor Whitbread. 77, 78.
I mean, that's quite the list, Robin, and there's plenty more sailing. We'll get to that in a second. It was, though, going to be 14 more years until there was another solo race around the world. That's a long time. Why do you think that was? I mean, do you think what you'd achieved had put everyone off? Perhaps you made it look too hard.
Well, I didn't want to make it look hard. I think it took 4 years before we had a crewed round the world race. I think the first Whitbread. That was 73, I think. Yes, it was. And I think confidence was building up. It wasn't a one-off, my getting round the world. It wasn't just a bit of luck or something. Actually, we can get these shots round the world, although they were obviously all bigger than Suhaili. So I think confidence was growing. And then an American, Dave White, formed the idea of a solo race around the world with stops. And he rang me and said, would I be interested in doing it? I said, I'd do it two-handed, but not single-handed. And next thing I knew was a chap had been on the cadetship with me. He was working for the BOC group. They were looking at sponsoring the race that Dave was organising. And he rang me and said, look, we'd like to come and have lunch and want to talk to you about running this race for them. So that's what I did in 82, 83, ran the race, first of the BSC Challenges, which was the first single-handed race around the world after the Golden Dome. Difference being it did stop. But nevertheless, it was sort of, I think it started opening up the floodgates. And we ran it again in 86. Then I handed over to Schrader because I thought, I'm dominating this too much. Other people should have a say. I remember Philip Jeantot phoning me one day about that time and saying, Robin, do you mind if I organise a non-stop race around the world? I said, well, I can't stop you. But how nice of you to ask me. I always got on well with Philippe. Very fond of him. Good bloke to try ideas with. Very practical diver and seaman. And so that was the beginning of the Vendée, which, of course, had been a huge success. I still think that's the toughest sporting event in the world. I don't care what people say. Perhaps heavyweight boxing is pretty tough, but actually the constant day after day after day on a boat, pushing it hard, however much we have automatic pilots and all the rest of the kit, I still think that's probably the toughest sporting event there is out there. And it attracts huge coverage in France, of course.
Well, Robin, I mean, you weren't just interested in shorthanded sailing, were you? I mean, in 1977, it was the second edition of the Whitbread Round the World race, now called the Ocean Race. You were co-skipper of Heath's Condor. What was the appeal of that race back then?
Well, I, you know, from 71 on, I'd done quite a lot of racing with crews, you know, Admiral's Cup and all this sort of thing, rock stuff. I'm quite happy sailing with crews, you know, as long as I've got congenial people and they're willing and want to win, I'll race with them. If they don't want to win, leave. We're not going to get on. So you might as well leave now before I fall out with you, or you fall out with me because you're leaving. I want people committed. I want intelligent people. I want people I don't have to ask to do a job. They've seen it and do it without being asked. They're the best crews. And a sense of humour, absolutely essential. And if you've got a crew like that, you're going to enjoy this because we're all pushing towards the same objective. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that whiplet, actually, and particularly the last leg, because Tarbley had been disqualified, but he was still there. And I hadn't raced him since 71, Cape Rio. And he got this big Penduick, big boat, and we got a big boat. So inevitably, it was going to be a competition. And I went have a go at him. And I caught him. He was better to windward than me, about the same off the wind. But he sails straight into the Azores High. And I saw it coming. I had one of my crew off watch. I said, your job now is to take down the Morse code of the weather forecast for the North Atlantic. He said, but it's too fast. I said, there's a tape recorder. Record it, halve the speed, and decode it, and do nothing else. And I watched the Azores High shift every 5 days. I said, it's going to sit on Tarbley. I'm going west. So I was pointing 120 degrees from the finish line to go and pick up the next depression coming in the Atlantic, which I did. And of course, then I'm flying. And the race committee, you had to report twice a week. So I rang my wife and said, darling, take the day and the month of your birthday from the following four figures. So I gave my lat and long, you know, lat, degrees and minutes, long, degrees and minutes. But I added the day and the month of her birthday, which happened to be the 10th. Fairly simple. She said, right, got that. Okay, now in 2 days' time, ring race control and say that was our position today. Won't lie about it. We're just late handing it in, but that's perfectly all right. Because everyone can listen in. You know, and I didn't want people to know where I was. I didn't want people to realise I was taking a flyer and it was paying off. So Susie did that. And of course, the race committee put it down for the day they received it, not the date she gave them. So we're coming up. We realise from the reports, I've got him. He's 40 miles behind me. He's not going to catch me now. And we're coming up, and I called him up the night before we finished, and race control, and said, oh, hello. Very exciting here. Looking forward to Eric Tarbley getting Lion Honours tomorrow. Very exciting. Got a special prize for him, you know, because he's not in the race, but we've got a special prize. Oh, that's jolly good. What time is he arriving? Oh, 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock. He'll be here by 2 o'clock. I'm sure he will. He's very professional. Yes, that's very good. Where are you? I said, well, I'm 40 miles south of Foy. Where? 40 miles south of Foy. Oh, jolly good, jolly good. When are you going to arrive? At 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. What? And that's when I arrived. And Eric came on board, and he came and he looked knackered. He said, how did you do it? I said, come look at the chart. We became quite good friends, actually. I had a lot of respect for him. And he said, yeah, that was very brave. I said, it wasn't, Eric. I was watching that Azores High. I was getting the messages through. He was getting messages, I think, from the French Navy, whereas I was just getting the traditional broadcast, and that's how I did it. So anyway, I got him. Very interesting in his biography. It doesn't mention that race.
I love though in the entire whitbread that's your moment beating Eric Tabelet back home into the UK. I mean, Robin, you'd spent, I mean, obviously a lot of time sailing in the Southern Ocean on Suhaili, but, you know, you were on your own. Whitbread's a different game, isn't it? I mean, you're carrying a much greater responsibility, you know, the lives of the men, your crew. How different did that feel, having that responsibility?
Well, I had a pretty good crew and we had time to work up. So by the time the race started, we were actually getting quite proficient. And I'd done that previously with Moropo and with the Admiral's Cup. We started training very early for that. So we got to the point we were really good. You know, we'd round a buoy and that spinnaker was up. We didn't wait three lengths before it went up. It went up now. And you know, that was the standard we had, and it's the standard I liked. You know, I feel this has been really competitive. What are we racing otherwise? The objective is to win, isn't it? It's like going to the boxing ring. Why come second? Just get hurt for nothing. Oh, let's go and win the damn thing. So it's really a question that I had this crew. I mean, we didn't have the safety equipment we have these days. You think back on it. We weren't wearing life jackets. We didn't have tethers. We did lose a guy overside. We got him back.
How terrifying. I mean, I read that in the book. How terrifying is that moment to lose someone?
Well, actually, you're so busy dealing with it. You know, what you've got. I've got him in the water. We've managed to get him a life ring. I can see where he is because it took a while to get the spinnaker under control and go back. But we could see where he was because the albatross was circling. And, you know, breakfast for them. So the engine wouldn't start. Then it started and the prop wouldn't open. And I had the staysail ready so we could sail back. And I said, get the staysail up, guys. Anyway, the engine eventually did open, start and prop open. And we motored back flat out. And we went up to windward of him. And as the boat lurched, two of us just leant over and just grabbed 16 stone, dropped it on board. Bit of adrenaline running. He was fine, actually, except he'd slightly hurt his hand. And so I said, right, you're on light duties, you're catering. And, oh, well, no, you know you're on deck, Bill. You can't hold on with one hand. You need one hand for yourself and one for the boat. You can come and sit on deck, but you can't work. Oh, okay, so after 2 days, he said, oh, I'm ready, Robin. I said, okay, grab that rope. And he grabbed it, and I pulled. He went, ow! I said, Bill, I don't have to tell you, do I? You're not going on deck. Not till your hand's better.
What kind of skipper are you, Robin? I mean, how do you lead your team?
I like to get the crew very involved. I like them to know what's going on. I like to develop them as much as I can. I've been training since a youngster, really. I'm in Merchant Navy. I was training officer on the cadet ship later on in my life. And Sail Training Association, all the rest of it. I've been involved in training. You don't get there by screaming and shouting. You get there by encouraging and making people realize why they want to learn something. You know, the objective is to learn this for a reason. However, if I've got a skiver in the crew, I will ride them. And I can't stop myself. And I do it because it's unfair to the others. You're skiving. Why aren't you down there cleaning out the bilges? You never do it, do you? Why'd you leave it to everyone else? Why don't you do the washing up for a change? And I'll start to run, I'll start to push them. And they either shape up or out. It's just not fair on the rest of the crew. Why should they do the work for you? And why are you last on deck every time we need people on deck? Yeah, I want to see you a little bit better than that. You're not doing your bit. You're a passenger. And your passage is going to end at the next port.
You should come and live with us, Robin, for a while. Teach my teenagers a thing or two. We have those discussions every day. I mean, Robin, you'd been ocean racing in multi-hulls for decades, hadn't you? And by the early 90s, there was talk of a new race. A tempting new challenge was launched in France. I mean, can you remember when you heard about the new Jules Verne trophy? To be awarded, of course, to the team who sailed around the world in less than 80 days. Did it excite you?
I picked that up. I don't know where. But a week later, I was attending a Whitbread race committee because I was on the committee and so was Peter Blake. And as we left, we walked away and, you know, we were chatting together. And he said, you heard about this Jules Verne trophy? I said, yep. What do you think? I think, brilliant. I've been thinking about how to put together a project. Yeah, me too. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm getting Fowler to design me a monohull with great big booms with weights on it so I can hold it upright and everything else. What are you doing? I said, I'm going to find the biggest bloody catamaran I can lay my hands on and take that. And I got my eyes on one anyway. So, you know, we just said, yeah, having any luck? No. Okay. Why don't we team up? Why not? So we did. And we found the New Zealand Apple and Pear Marketing Board were really interested. So Peter flew to New Zealand to deal with that. I flew to the States to look at the old Mike Birch's boat. 92-foot cat. So Pete came back with a contract, and we put in an offer for the boat and got it. And then we went over to France for the announcement. And I said to the French organisers, you know, we'd like to make an announcement. Oh, yes, of course, but you have to wait. First, we must hear from French sailors who are going to do this. Okay. Perron, particularly. So he gets up and says his plans. Everyone applauds. Wonderful. Last time I saw Matesse, it was at that meeting. And then someone else says, well, he was thinking of doing, fantastic. Yes. And then someone starts talking about his transatlantic. And I said to the chap, Cheng, I said, excuse me. Yes, you must wait. Yes, wait. And this. And I said, excuse me. Yes. He says, oh, but I'm going to wish this boat across the Atlantic. I will be so fast. I will do this. Yeah, okay. I said, excuse me. Robin, you want to say something? Yes, I do, actually. You've heard of the All Blacks rugby team, have you? Yes, we've been sure. Well, there's an organisation in New Zealand called the Apple and Pear Marketing Board, and because my French isn't very good, I brought along an apple and a pear. Matesse took a knife out of his pocket, peeled the apple and ate it. It's quite funny. So Peter Blake and I have teamed up. We've bought Mike Birch's boat. We're sponsored by the Apple and Pear Marketing Board. And we'll be on the start line at the end of January. And you could see them go very quiet. Oh, shit. The bloody Anglo-Saxons are here. And those two don't sail to come second. And so next day, actually, we flew over to the States, got hold of the boat, launched it, brought her over here and improved her somewhat. And off we set. And of course, we hit something in the Southern Ocean. Perron got in just under 80 days. Good effort, I have to say. But we were sitting on him. And every day was breaking things. We weren't. We were just sitting there. And we said, we got steam in the kettle here when we need it. But then we hit something. So we're out. And we thought, well, that's the end of it. Got the boat home. And then the Apple and Pear Marketing Board rang up and said, hey, guys, fancy doing it again? He said, do I fancy doing it again? Of course I fancy doing it again. Well, we've just looked at the publicity we got. We'd like to have another go. Will you do it? So we did. And that's when we dropped it by about 5 days. We're still the only non-French team to ever won that trophy, you know, which isn't good news. And the French are very good at it. I mean, there's no question there. I mean, we did it in just under 75 days. That record's now down to almost 40. I mean, phenomenal, really, isn't it? And that's 25 years.
And how different, Robin, was that? Was that second attempt? You know, you'd done a bit of the course on that boat. You knew what it was like to sail. You know, how different was the approach?
We modified the boat quite a lot, and carbon mast, fibre rigging. That was the equivalent to taking a mini out of the boat at 35 feet above the deck. Cuts your pitching moment, reduces the risk of heeling, you know, all the good things, lightens the boat. We lengthened her a bit, changed her underwater shape. David Allen Williams did that. And we had a much faster boat when we were ready for that second attempt. And you felt it. You know, you could feel how easily she drove. We're off, coming up from Dunedin, and a front came through, and I mean, she just skidded up to 32 knots like that. You know, shoom. I was just with a hey, this is looking good. Crew, 8 of us, one of whom was a cameraman. His job was to film, not to get involved. One or two crew changed. Stanbridge had left us. But basically, it was about the same people. But we had an experienced team on board and good people.
Describe what it was like pushing for a record in the Southern Ocean in a machine like that. I mean, we've spoken to Francois Gabart on the podcast about his approach to record breaking in his giant multi-hull. But back then with ENSA, you were really trying to tame the beast. I mean, relatively untested while still racing the clock. What's your memories of that time? And also of your partnership with Peter?
Well, the memories of the time are Peter got injured as we entered the Southern Ocean. We went down the mine. We'd overtaken the wave in front and gone to the back of the other one, stopped dead, and we were doing about 28 knots. And of course, he lost grip, which I'm not surprised anyone would, and fell back on the chart table and actually chipped his back. So we had him in his bunk for about 10 days. Those 10 days, we averaged 480 miles a day. Was it just over that? 485, was that? I'd have to look it up. It's over 480 miles a day. And you're on this big platform. It's like being on a tray sliding down a sand dune. You have no control. Yeah, obviously we can steer it, but you can't see at night. The moon isn't up. You're just plowing along. You can see occasionally the white of the waves, because ideally you want the wind on the quarter. That's perfect. You know, you're going to bring it forward, apparent wind. But that's about. I've always found if I put a catamaran or multi-hull on about 70 degrees apparent wind, it's pretty close to the sweet point. And it's very rarely wrong, that. I don't know, I discovered that very early on. But yeah, just keep going. Just put her on 70. Okay, it's 63 on this one. Or it's 78 or something. But it's going to be in that little gap. And so you're just trying to keep her there. And just plough. Just keep going. And of course, you have the speed to keep ahead of the waves. But nighttime. And we had a rolling watch system, which I think was one of our better innovations. Three on deck. And every hour, one changed. So you'd come on watch, and you spend the first hour getting familiar. Next hour, you'd steered. Next hour, you're familiarising the next step coming up. So that was a very good system, worked very well for us, I have to say. And Peter and I lived in the pod in the middle, which was great because we could discuss everything. We had very good American Bob Rice as our doing our weather for us. And we'd call him up daily and chat to him about it. And, you know, we'd sit there and ask questions, look at the charts and everything else. But it was a very good circular discussion. It's what you need, you know, what's going to happen here? You know, and on one occasion we didn't agree with Bob and we did what we thought was right. And so that's it. And we just pushed on. And of course, we got mucked up after New Zealand and Curses on, who was out against us. Closed the gap. We got 1,500 mile lead on him. Was it 1,300, something like that? He closed right up to within about 300 miles. And then Curzon said, "I'm going to refuse to give my position." And they said, "What do we think of that?" I said, "He's not doing very well." And eventually came up with his position some days later. He said, "We told you. We've extended the lead on him." But that was fun because we got into Brest and we got a most fantastic welcome by the French. I mean, it was phenomenal. The place was absolutely jam-packed. And we were treated extremely well. And Olivier Kirsten arrived about 2 days later. We went down. Olivier's an old friend of mine. And I went down and jumped on board and said, "Olivier, fantastic, well done." We were shaking hands. He said, "Robin, I hate you." Of course, we both broke into laughter. So you've got to understand, Olivier. We were the two patrons of the last Brest Festival. And the mayor took us out to lunch, and he couldn't understand the rudeness we flung at each other. Then he began to realise, actually, this was our normal treatment, and beneath it lay a very strong bond of friendship.
It's such an exciting race. Not only a race, obviously, between the two of you, but racing the clock. And, you know, you did knock 5 days off Bruno's record, you know, finishing in 74 days and 22 hours. When you did cross that line, that ushant finish line, you know, and you knew that you'd done enough, what was the emotion like on board?
Well, you see, it was blowing quite hard. We had a load of stuff hanging out the back because we didn't want to go down the mine again. You know, this mast and rigging had been taking it for the last 74 days. If something breaks now, we've lost the record. All right, we've got it in the bank. Let's just get across that finish line safely. So you see the pictures of, we've only got a staysail up. We're still surfing in. There's a big French destroyer nearby us. You know, that's the way the French go for it. Okay. We've done it. We're in one piece. Cheers. Right, next thing is let's get her in. So let's get her into port. So get her alongside. And once you've tied your boat up, then you can start to relax.
Massive relief, I guess.
Yes, it is. In one piece. And you've done it. And our wives are out there. I mean, it was fantastic. And no, it was just great. And we were treated very, very well, I have to say. Brest, I mean, is a great place to go to anyway, but for that return, we got tremendous reception from the French. And a genuine sporting appreciation, you know.
A good moment.
We put an advert in the paper. We got 8,000 answers. My amateurs have done a better job than the Whitbread crews. Mike Golding and Alex Thompson told me I was too old to race one of those boats.
In 1996, we saw the very first clipper race. Amateurs under the tutelage of a professional skipper circumnavigating the planet. Am I right in thinking that the concept for the race was hatched during a climbing trip to Greenland with the famous British mountaineer Chris Bonington? I mean, how did the idea for the clipper race come about?
Well, you're absolutely right. That's where it was hatched. You see, you sit around all day when you're travelling across glaciers because the bridges across crevasses are too soft and you travel at night. So you're sitting around all day, probably bare-chested to the sun. You know, you're north of the Arctic Circle, but it's actually warm till the sun disappears. And Chris was talking about his recent trip up Mount Everest, how much it cost and everything else. And it's about 40,000 a person. I thought, God, that's a lot of money. What's the sailing equivalent? For me, it's a circumnavigation. It's not the Olympics, it's circumnavigation. Oh, I wonder if there are people out there who'd love to do that. Got a boat and haven't got the confidence or can't afford a boat. How much would I have to charge them if I supplied the boat and the skipper, food, clothing, ports and everything else? I did a quick sketch on the back of an envelope, basically. It was about slightly above half the cost of climbing Mount Everest. So I met William and we got together on this. So we put an advert in the paper saying we're planning on doing this. We got 8,000 answers. Well, once you've launched an idea like that, if you don't do it, someone else will. So in 11 months, we managed to build 8 boats from scratch, train up crews. I went around the world fixing up the ports, recruit our skippers and start the race. It was all done in 11 months and went very smoothly, in fact. Good people helping. And that's how we did it. And that was the first tipper race. Well, of course, it finished. And what are we going to do with these boats now? Because our original plan had been to join a different event, just be part of it. But that fell through, so we had to set up our own event, which wasn't our original intention. Oh, what do we do with these boats now? But do it again, I suppose. What, 4 years? 4 years won't work financially. I mean, it was very clear to us the moment you did a cash flow projection. It's got to be 2 years. So we started advertising. That taught us a lesson. You need longer to build up. We weren't quite full that race, so we just about broke even. I think we may have made a very small loss, but at least we carried on. We covered all our costs. But for the 2000 race, we were prepared, and so we filled that one. And then we started on the roll.
It's been a phenomenal success, hasn't it? I mean, running now for 24 years. Are you surprised that it's really stood the test of time? And what is it, do you think, that makes it still so incredibly popular?
I think there's a lot of people out there who want something special in their lives. The fact that we've got a very good organisation with some very good people in it, got a cracking team, a very dedicated, hard-working, reasonable people. But the work gets done. And the training now is 4 weeks. You know, they come into the training. If they're not going to like it, they'll find out then. Fine. OK, you've had 2 weeks training. There's the rest of your money back. It has, I think, what we did, we realised, initially it was mainly British, we realised that wasn't sustainable. We got to expand. So over 50% of our crews now come from non-Brits. In fact, 43 nations in this race. And so we've expanded it, and that's gets publicity in those countries. So whereas it used to be British were the biggest single group, and then the Australians, the Americans have now taken over as the second biggest group, which is interesting. But I think there's a market there for it. But we've built up so much experience now, and we've got such a good team. And someone said, well, suppose someone else started up. I said, well, that did happen once. Didn't work. Okay, losing a year's income, which is what's happening now, is going to hurt us. But we've done the projections. We can get through. So pick up the race again. Hopefully a year on, you know, because of the weather patterns of the world, it has to be like that.
The Mount Everest model has come under much criticism, hasn't it? I mean, too many amateurs on the mountain, pay-as-you-go climbers, leading to an increase in, you know, accidents and fatalities. The Clipper race has also had its share of difficult times, its tragic losses. And like the Everest operations, it has its critics. How hard is it, Robin, to get the balance of safety and adventure right?
Well, I always reckon that the essence of good seamanship is safety. So therefore, there can only be one balance, and that's safety. We've developed some stuff with Clipper. You know, we've seen an idea. I've got a very good close team of mainly people who skip it for me around the world. People I trust, and we'll go out and try things out. That's how we came up with a two-tether system. One short, one long. Use the long one for getting round the boat, and the short one when ship's stationary. We developed our own life jackets. Our harness is now specially made for us. I won't have plastic in them because we had one go. Lost a chap overside. We got him back, but plastic had been trodden on. Seemed to be all right, but it wasn't. Right, we have gunmetal now. All our clips are gunmetal. And they cost more, but, you know, life is invaluable. We've had three accidents. We've lost three people. We've had five overside. We've always got the person back. Sadly, twice they've drowned. We've always got them back. Compare that with the Whitbread, 7 deaths. They've only got 3 back. You know, my amateurs have done a better job than the Whitbread crews. And that's partly because it's trained into them. They all say when they get that awful cry, man overboard, it was just automatic. We'd done it so many times, we didn't think. I said, well, that's great. Now, that's how I want you. Before every leg of the race, they do a man overboard drill. Every week they're out training. They'll do at least one, possibly more. It becomes instilled in them. And it's absolutely vital. That's why we've never left a body floating. You know, we've always got them back. The three we've lost, first one, broke one of our rules, tragic, boat jibed. He was gone over the top of the main track. That's not allowed. Came up on his harness, boom, hit him, killed him. Next one, nighttime, hands on deck, bringing in the spinnaker or something. And this girl didn't clip on. Wave came in, just took her overside. Got her back, but she drowned. Next one, we still don't know the real story. His tether broke. The clip obviously caught something and distorted. And he went overside. And by the time we got him back, he was drowned, unfortunately. We had 3 medical people on board. That was just a tragic accident. But it was a top of the range piece of kit. And initially I changed all the harnesses just to give everyone a bit of confidence. You know, I exchanged them all. But end of the next leg, they said, look, come here, the other one's back. Then I said, okay. I've now got £30,000 worth of tethers I don't need, but anyway, never mind. Harnesses were fine, it was the tethers. We still don't know exactly what happened. The MAIB came to an immediate conclusion, but that's not agreed with by the crew who were there at the time. So we don't know. All you can say is it got caught on something and distorted. But we've been over there and we've done the tests there with the company, and we're breaking them. We're taking the point where they break. They're all ahead of the international standard. All of them. They've never broken under it, not once. So I don't know what else you do unless we come up with a fundamental redesign of the clip, which I think probably is what we're going to have to do at some point. And I hope some people are thinking about it.
It's fundamentally full of risks, though, isn't it? Ocean racing, and you're taking people who are relatively inexperienced. I mean, how would you answer those critics?
Well, it's an extreme sport. We make it as safe as we can. We instill safety into you, but you've got to stop horse riding. More people fall off mountains in this country that die in sailing accidents. You're going to abandon mountaineering. You know, it's an extreme sport. There's an urge in humans to challenge themselves or just to get an experience if they don't want to challenge themselves. We're never going to change that. What we can do is try and make it as safe as we can. And I think 5,000 people going around the world, which is what we've had now, I've had 3 fatalities. It's three too many, I'd agree. But hey, that's not a bad safety record.
Robin, to the surprise of many people, in 2006, you entered the Velox 5 Ocean Race. Much was made of the fact that you were 68 at the time. It was a solo race around the world with a few stopovers in Amokas, the modern ocean racing machines. Why did you take that on, Robin? Were you still in need of a big adventure?
I think it's down to Mike Golding and Alex Thompson, who told me I was too old to race one of those boats. And that upset me. And I thought, I can sail one of those boats. I'm as strong as you, pretty fit. I've got a lot of experience. I'm not doubting your experience, particularly Mike, but come on, guys. And I'm a good seaman, probably better than either of you at that. I nursed my boat. So I went away on, I was lecturing on the Queen Mary, QE2. I said, oh, hell with it. And I put in a bid for this boat, a ridiculously low bid. And while I was still on the QE2, got an email from Bernard Galley saying, your offer's been accepted. And what have I done now? So the next thing is to find a sponsor. Well, they were really shamed into it, weren't they? I mean, Saga. For the over 50s, they had to support me, really. And I built up a small team. That was it, really. But, I mean, neither Alex nor Mike got as far as Australia. So they had these big professional teams. I had my amateur friends. Very happy with them, thank you. The ones I knew and could trust.
That's funny, Alex and Mike eating their words. I mean, by then, nearly 40 years had passed since you'd sailed alone in Suheli around the world. How different did it all feel circumnavigating this time?
It's so much faster, isn't it? And you've got so much more equipment. I mean, all these computers, plotters, downloading the weather 4 times a day, being able to really make some very good tactical judgments, which wasn't possible before, with just a barometer and looking at the wind direction and the clouds. But I think that basic training of sailing with barometer, wind and clouds was invaluable, because it's still there. You know, I can still look at it and say, I don't believe that. That's not going to happen. But on the other hand, forecasts have got better and better. But they're essential. I mean, when I lost my satellite communications for a while, people couldn't understand why I was desperate for the other boats' positions. Because I could tell if they got wind or not from how fast they were going. So, okay, they're down there. I need to go down there. Well, they slowed up, come back up here. But I had no weather information for some days. And I lost on them. And then I got the thing working again eventually. Now I could catch up.
But did you enjoy it?
I did, actually. I have a very simple little system. I will have dinner at about 6 in the evening. That's a good time to have a meal. At 5 o'clock, I'm going to have an hour off. You know, providing I can, obviously. But if everything's going fine, I will sit in the cockpit with a glass of whiskey and a cigarette. And I will go through the day and I'll think about the weather and what I'm reading and what's likely to happen. Have I thought of that? And it's my quiet think time. And you know, I just sit there. That I used to look forward to that hour because it was very relaxing. But it was also when I did an awful lot of tactical thinking. I remember sitting there once, and half an hour, and I was watching my boat, and the big waves, big swell, and as she went down in the troughs, she slowed up because the wind's going over the top. And then as the next wave came up, as she came up, she'd accelerate. It was only 10 tons. And I just watched these waves just failing to splash on board. And I was sitting there, this is fantastic. And then one did. Straight into my whiskey and put my cigarette up. I was livid.
You should, a man of your age should know better.
I know. I know. There you are. Is that what went wrong that day?
Much expense, I'm sure, Robin. You recommissioned Suheli. She no longer sits in the Maritime Museum. She's here with you on the south coast of England. I've been lucky enough to sail with you on her. You know her so well. How special is it for you that she's still this massive part of your life?
Oh, I think she'll always be part of my life. You know, I'm probably going over to work on the boats this afternoon. She'll pop down, run her engine up, check her bilges, see she's all right, you know, fix the problems I've got with my boat. And I'll probably take Suhaili out. If I wanted to sail this weekend, I'd take Suhaili out. All I got to do is walk on board, bend on the jib, off I go. So, and if you keep a boat in commission, of course you do those little jobs, don't you? You just keep her in a good state. So I don't like leaving her for too long without taking her out, because then neglect comes in, you know. The other day I was over there and I was doing some varnishing in one boat and I said, a bit of varnish left, you can't put it back in the pot, it goes off. I'll hand it round to Sailing, give her another coat. You know, so. Yeah, so she's very important to me. I mean, she's been part of my life since I was 23. I mean, I've done so much with her and she's done so much for me too. I always say any fool could get her around the world. I proved it.
You've packed it all in, haven't you, Robin? I mean, endless adventure. I mean, a lifetime of adventure, pushing beyond most people's limits. You've been the first to achieve something that many people doubted was even possible. But through Clipper, you've also introduced thousands of people to the world of ocean racing. When you look back now, what do you think has been your greatest achievement? What are you proudest of?
There's sort of two answers to that, really. From a purely personal point of view, it was obviously getting Suhaili around the world. But equally, when I look at all the lives that have benefited from Clipper, and the number of those sailors, 40% never been on a boat before, who've taken up sailing subsequently as their sport. It's, to my mind, that is going to rank pretty highly, because those over 5,000 people now taking the sport up all over the world, it's given me people I bump into all over the world, which is lovely. I think possibly that, but it's two sort of totally different fields, isn't it, really? All right, they both involve boats, but one is giving people an opportunity in life, which does change them. It quite noticeably changes them. Come back much more confident. And pretty good seaman, actually. Remember doing a race once in Nova Scotia. We were over there. And I only had four of the crew on board. I was racing with some locals, just three boats out. And these four were round the worlders. I thought, I'd sail with you lot any time. What good crew you've become. Felt so proud of them. You know, they were really good. I thought, you don't have to tell you to do things you're anticipating. Perfect crew. Pleasant with it. When sitting down, chatting to people nicely, but always watching. You got that alertness a sailor needs to have. They got it by then. Just great to see.
Well, that's a great compliment. Robin, thanks so much for your time. As always, a massive pleasure. Thank you. The first man to sail alone non-stop around the planet, Sir Robin Knox Johnston. I hope you enjoyed his stories from a lifetime spent at sea. And as you heard in that last answer there, a man with a very traditional sense of modesty, but a man that has, nonetheless, given a huge amount to the sport of sailing. Do send us any feedback. We'd love to hear from you. It's all important in the podcast world. So please let me know what you think, leave us a review, and do please subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on. As you'll all know by now, this podcast is produced by Tim at Vertigo Films. A big thank you to Tim for all his time and hard work making the podcast. And thanks too to Phil at Portsmouth Sailing Club for helping us out with a venue to record this edition of the pod. So that's it from me until next time. It would, of course, have been the postponed Tokyo Olympics in August. So to help fill the Olympic sailing void, we're bringing you an Olympic sailing special edition. Look out for that, coming your way early August. Thank you so much for listening, and sail safe, everyone.
Newcastle 1. Race officer speaking.
Pressure coming here, pressure coming.
We're 1.5 below.
Two dives here, boys.
We're looking at 10.5 to 42. 5 to 42.
This is Castle 1 standing by. Out.